More than 500,000 are expected for tomorrow's nationwide March for Our Lives. This hour, we hear from one student in Des Moines. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, lawmakers deal the Regents big cuts to the current budget, lessons from the Facebook data breach. I speak with the granddaughter of one of the famed Sullivan brothers, also with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about political activism in sports. He's coming to Iowa. And remembering Sonia Kendrick of Feed Iowa First. Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few minutes, I'll talk with digital media scholar Michael Bougea of Iowa State University about that Facebook data breach and what it should remind us in terms of social media lessons. But first, this week, Iowa lawmakers struck a deal in an effort to balance the current budget, cutting state programs and services by over $35 million this year. And Iowa's public universities are being hit hardest by the cuts. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg joins me. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
So I'm looking. The Iowa Board of Regents will see about $11 million in cuts for the current budget year, which ends on June 30th.
Only three more months to go. They've got to accommodate that, and UNI is exempt. That is, they aren't in this $11 million that need be cut from the University of Iowa and Iowa State, as you know.
Okay, so UNI, the reasoning UNI is exempt?
I can't tell you exactly because I did not listen to the debate, but historically, having listened to legislators and covering the Board of Regents, UNI has, number one, a smaller budget. UNI has 90% of its students paying in-state tuition. So there may be factors.
Okay, what has been the reaction to these big budget cuts from the Regents, from the University of Iowa, ISU? What can you tell us there?
Well, the Regents have to be very careful because they're trying to keep good relationships with legislators. They've worked over the years under Regents President Craig Lang, Bruce Rastetter followed him, now Michael Richards. They've been trying to repair what they feel are maybe hostile feelings, elitism in the state universities and things like that among some state legislators, and that might have affected appropriations that have fallen dramatically since the early 2000s up to where we are right now. I can comment on that later. But they have to be careful how they react to what is a budget, not crisis, but budget difficulty for the entire state.
Mm-hmm. So what will this mean for these large public universities, ISU and the University of Iowa, as you said, with only a few months left in this current budget?
Yes. Well, what I think that you're going to see, and they don't have very long, as you say, to deal with these cuts. They can immediately restrict travel, reduce personnel costs by terminating staff at University of Iowa and at Iowa State University who have temporary appointments. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to see any effect on students per se, but you will see the effect on students in the future in tuition increases because the Regents still have not settled what the tuition rate is going to be for the fall semester. And so that decision is yet to be coming. So they'll defer as much expense as they can into the next fiscal year, and I think you can look for a significant tuition increase, not only because of this $11 million cut, but because of overall, the overall trend is continuing of reduced state funding.
Okay, so that's what I'm going to ask. This fits into a longer-term trend that we've been seeing, and you expect to continue into the future.
Well, yes. In fact, it's not unusual to have a mid-year cut like this. Back in the year 2000, 6% and 5% in the middle of 2004. In 2010, a 10% reduction in the overall university budget across all state agencies, as you know. So it's not unusual. Now, how will the effect be on tuition? I think the table is being set in the universities for significant tuition increases. I think that you saw that the universities have gone to the legislature because the legislature usually argued, oh, there's plenty of fat in university budgets and so on. So the universities have undertaken a very drastic and pervasive cost-cutting efficiency study, and they have enacted those. And so they wanted to go back to the legislature and say, look, this is what we've done. We the fat's gone. In fact, we're into the bone right now. So now I think that the universities only have one choice, and that is to raise tuitions significantly. That is, the regents will do that. And that's coming up. You're going to hear that within the next month or so, because Iowa State and the University of Iowa tried to compensate or offset the reduced state funding over the years by increasing enrollments. Mm-hmm. Let's do it by volume. Well, they're at the point right now where they can't accommodate the volume that they're at. And so there's already talk by Bruce Harreld at the University of Iowa and by Iowa State University that they are no longer going to increase enrollments. I think you're going to see an enrollment cap, and that tuitions will be significantly increased.
Okay. Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, the big story causing a buzz nationwide this week, the Cambridge Analytica scandal involving Facebook this week. Mark Zuckerberg, the social media giant's chief executive, publicly addressed the crisis facing his company. It came several days after reports about the misuse of data from 50 million of its users. Joining me now with his words of advice and reaction, Michael Bouget, a professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University. He's an ethicist and author of 23 books. His latest book we talked about not too long ago here on this program, Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine. It's in the second edition. In it, writing about how our dependence on digital technology is dramatically changing. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
So give us your thoughts on this scandal. You've written a blog post about, titled, I Told You So, Facebook, Your Data, and Trump.
Yeah, you know, back in July, I started investigating what all these pop quizzes were, these surveys, you know, we'll tell you your IQ. How would you look if you're a male? How would you look like as a woman? What celebrity do you most resemble? All these things. And what they do is once you log into those surveys with your Facebook account, it actually gives them permission to dive into everything that you have, or most of the things that you have, put in terms of your profile, your likes, your dislikes, the speed, Ben, at which these machines, these super processors can actually get from you has given us this age of big data. And that's why, you know, in my book, I have a chapter called Big Data, Little People, because the data is far more important than any particular profile, but those profiles can tell a lot about you.
Mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg saying, we made big mistakes, there's more to do, we need to step up and do it. Many lawmakers, researchers, unimpressed by the statements by Mr. Zuckerberg. Do you see the chance here for Facebook?
I'm not impressed at all with Mark Zuckerberg. I haven't been impressed with Mark Zuckerberg since 2006. That's 12 years ago. Essentially, Mark Zuckerberg has one thing on his mind, and it's profit. And boy, has he really hit his goals with that. I took a look at his statement. He says, we have a responsibility to protect your data, and if we can't, we don't deserve to serve you. But the problem is, if you use Facebook and you haven't read the terms of service, there's really nothing that you can do in the wake of this. And what his statement says is, well, don't worry, because this can't happen. What Cambridge Analytica did can't happen again. And for those listeners who don't understand what happened with Cambridge Analytica, a Cambridge University researcher named Alexander Krogan used one of those personality quiz apps, and he got the profile of about 300,000 people, and then he got into their likes and dislikes, but he also got into their friends. So it was a great harvest of data. And that eventually was culled and I think weaponized by Steve Bannon. So, you know, it's interesting because he's a professor, as I'm a professor as well, and probably in the same subject area. And Krogan is saying that Cambridge Analytica has made him a scapegoat. And there's a quote in response to Zuckerberg that he says, and I think it's worth listening to. It says, the project that Cambridge Analytica has allegedly done, which is use people's Facebook data for micro-targeting, is the primary use case for most data on these platforms. He goes on to say that there's an agreement between the user that you will allow advertisers to cull this information. And he's absolutely right. The news thing, the news angle on this from a journalism perspective is that this is just coming out. But those who have studied social media have been warning people about this for a decade at least. I know I have since 2006. Mm-hmm. Privacy is dead. Be careful what you post. Do not overshare. And this service is not for free.
Okay, give us some concrete advice, Michael. Disillusioned Facebook users are leaving the service. What do you say to those who are considering leaving Facebook, either, I guess, deactivating or deleting an account? Would you recommend that?
You know, there are other social media markets that are doing the same thing. So Twitter is doing the same thing. LinkedIn is doing the same thing to a certain degree. There have been attempts to create social networks without all this data mining. Elo was one of them. So there's not really any place to go. But here's the difference, and this is an important point, Ben, that you're bringing up. I use Facebook, all right? I use a cell phone in my car. But the difference between me and someone else, not necessarily everyone, but someone else, is I've read the terms of service. I know that if I overshare something on Facebook, it could be used against me. My superiors at Iowa State University can read it. Although I do have political preferences, I try to take pains in expressing them in polite language. I also know that when I'm using my cell phone in the car, I stop my car, get on the side of the road, because if there's an increase, you can have an accident. It's knowing the nature, Ben, of technology, knowing what you're doing and what others are doing to you through that window. I have a saying, when we're looking at a screen, we think that no one else is looking back at us through windows. I can tell you, everyone is looking back now in the age of big data.
And it's really amazing, Michael. How does Facebook, I heard the quote, Facebook, after you like something perhaps 67 times, I think with the number I saw, the algorithm knows you better than perhaps your spouse does.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting that you mention spouses. There have been studies showing that Facebook is one of the chief reasons now for divorce. You know, a firm in a British law firm called it the new marriage minefield. Another study says that it's not only a leading cause of divorce, but 4 out of 5 lawyers now use Facebook posts as evidence in divorce cases. So the whole thing about this is be careful how you use these. Now, Facebook is particularly concerning to me because it takes your data for free. It mines your data, it sells your data, and it advertises for your data. It's making money on what you tell others on that social platform. And the service terms, which you should read, say things like, you grant us a non-exclusive, transferable, sub-license, royalty-free license to use your content anywhere, to sell it to others, all this stuff. Now, everybody should read those service terms, and you don't necessarily have to give up Facebook. I'm not trying to tell you to give up Facebook. I'm telling you to know what you're dealing with. Interpersonal divide in the age of the machine says this about technology. It has a nature. That nature is not amoral, it's not moral, but it changes everything it touches without itself being changed at all. And when it comes to Facebook, you can invite danger into your life, you can invite sorrow into your life, or happiness, but you got to know what you're doing. And you have to know what the service terms are before you post things.
Okay, Michael, before we go, very quickly, comment. Shouldn't we expect lawmakers, our lawmakers, to do something? Can they do something?
Yeah, they can do something. Well, first of all, they can do something politically. There's this Honest Ads Act. It's a bill in the U.S. Senate, and it's bipartisan. I think it has Amy Klobuchar, Mark Warner, and John McCain. It's supposed to limit what companies can do in selling data associated with political campaigns. You know, that's nice, but I think that Facebook needs to be regulated as a utility. And if it's regulated as a utility, you know, we can actually enforce some different service terms by privacy law, which I'm concerned about. So, you know, it's whether this Congress can even get along with each other, whether they can pass a bipartisan bill. But the point of this is that, you know, we are citizens, we are users, and we don't like our data stolen without our permission.
Okay, Michael Bouget, a professor in the Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication at Iowa State University, author of the latest edition of Interpersonal Divide in the Age of the Machine. Always nice to get your insights, Michael. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate this.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Maybe you saw the latest Time magazine. Well, the cover features five determined-looking survivors of the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, who are spearheading a national movement for gun control. The headline declares, "Enough." It's a movement looking to redefine the gun control debate in the weeks since a gunman killed 17 people at that Florida school. Tomorrow, kids and families of March for Our Lives will take to the streets of Washington, D.C. and communities across the U.S. Here's an ad from March for Our Lives.
To the gun manufacturers who count on sales to go up every time kids are killed in their classrooms, we see you.
To the politicians who trade the lives of their constituents for a paycheck from gun lobbyists,
we see you very well.
To the NRA, who pretend that weapons designed to maximize human slaughter have anything to do with the Second Amendment,
we see you.
And to the people marching this Saturday,
the people saying,
"Never again,"
we'll see you there.
Now, tomorrow's nationwide protest against gun violence is expected to attract more than 500,000 teens and adults to the nation's capital, also to sister marches across the country, here in Iowa as well. Isabella O'Connor is with us, a student at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines. Hi, Isabella. You'll be taking part, right?
Hi. Yes, I will be taking part. I was also part of the planning in it. I'm going to be speaking as well.
Okay. What is planned?
Well, in the Iowa Sister March, at least, starting at 12:45, there's going to be some opening acts in booths of Moms Demand Action, like high school. There's a Young Feminist Club coming. And then there's going to be some opening acts, like some slam poets. There's going to be break dancers. And starting at 2, we're going to have speakers. There's going to be several students speaking, a few teachers, a former NRA member, a current gun owners, and parents who have been affected by gun control issues.
Mm-hmm. Isabella, you said you'll be speaking as well. What is your angle on this specifically?
As a young person who could have been affected by this tragedy, it could have been at my school, I would like to make sure it never happens again. And so we are calling on our legislators for more gun control and to have safer schools.
Mm-hmm. Specifically in terms of what lawmakers can do, what specifically do you think is realistic?
Well, there are several things that March for Our Lives has come out of in support of. One of the ones is creating a 3-day background check, like a 3-day waiting period. We want universal background checks. We would like to see AR-15 bans as well as high-capacity magazines and bump stocks. We'd also like to see an increase in mental health services across the nation.
Mm-hmm. We heard an ad for March for Our Lives there. I'd like to play you an ad from that was just put out recently by the NRA. And have you listened to it? And it's obviously aimed at to the activism that's going on. I'd like to have you respond to it. Let's listen.
Okay. They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Isabella O'Connor, what do you think of that from the NRA?
I'm honestly dumbfounded right now. I have never heard that ad. I've never heard anything like that. It sounds like they're really trying to pit people against each other, which is exactly what we're trying not to do. We are trying to save people's lives, and they're trying to, they say they're trying to save the Second Amendment, but we're not trying to take the Second Amendment away. We're just trying to restrict it to a sort where we need sensible gun control. It's not that hard. We want comprehensive gun control to protect our children in schools. We're not, this is not a liberal agenda. This is not Obama's agenda. This is children who friends and family were murdered standing up for themselves because the people who died in this massacre can't do it.
Do you imagine, and imagine this is true of you and your classmates, what it must have been like at Parkland or the other schools hit by this epidemic of gun violence?
Well, when I was in middle school, actually, we had an active shooter threat, and we got on lockdown for 3 hours. I attended Merrill Middle School, and I was in seventh grade at the time, and there were children having panic attacks. There were children sitting and crying, not knowing what was going to happen. Every time we heard a door handle jiggle, we all froze up because we didn't know what that could mean for us. I can't imagine if we heard gunshots, if we heard bullets, if we heard screams.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, it was just a threat, and it wasn't a reality. But for these children who it was reality for, I can't imagine what they're going through. They're not only having to deal with the loss of someone that they love, they're having to deal with the fear, the constant fear.
Isabella, do you think this attempt to redefine the gun control debate will lead to meaningful change?
I do. We're already seeing it. The president came out to say that, he's also gone back on it already too, but that he would be in favor of some gun control. Florida's already made some movements. They're holding town halls, the one with Marco Rubio. And students across the nation are demanding action. You know, when children have to get involved, it's something's about to change. Because when the youngest generation changes, we're going to inspire the older generations to change as well, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this will make a difference at the ballot box?
I absolutely do. I can vote in November for my first time. And I know how I'm voting.
Well, Isabella O'Connor, thank you very much for talking with us, a student at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines, taking part in the March for Our Lives protest, the Sister March in Des Moines. Where will it take place, Isabella?
It will take place at the Iowa State Capitol in Des Moines. The speakers start at 2, and we're going to start marching around 3:15, and we're going to do some chants. I hope to see you all there.
Thanks, Isabella.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Still to come, after a short break, I speak with the granddaughter of one of the famed Sullivan brothers about the discovery of the wreck of the USS Juno. Also with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar about political activism. He's coming to Iowa. It's your NewsBuzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it was the greatest military loss by any one American family during the Second World War. The five Sullivan brothers of Waterloo, George Francis, Joseph Madison, and Albert, aged between 19 and 27 years old, lost their lives when their ship, the USS Juno, was sunk by a Japanese submarine during the naval Battle of Guadalcanal on November 13, 1942. 687 men aboard, including the Iowa brothers, died in that sinking. Now, 76 years later, the wreckage of that World War II ship has been found by an expedition crew owned by Microsoft co-founder and philanthropist Paul Allen. Here's the moment the discovery was confirmed by the crew via video image from more than 2.5 miles below the surface off the coast of the Solomon Islands, crew member Robert Kraft making out the letters on the rusty hull of the USS Juno.
Well, that's going to be the J. There's the U, N, E. Here's the A. That's it. That is the Juno.
Kelly Sullivan joins me now, the granddaughter of the youngest of the Sullivan brothers, Albert Sullivan. She's a third grade teacher in Cedar Falls. Kelly Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
What was your reaction, your family's reaction, when you heard the news, when you actually saw the wreckage of the Juno?
Right. You know, I got goosebumps just listening to you, listening to the video again just now. I actually watched the video with my third graders because I was in Florida. Talk about serendipity. I was on the ship USS the Sullivans when the discovery happened on St. Patrick's Day. So I didn't have a chance to watch the video until I got back to Iowa. And when they started spelling it out, you know, before they started spelling it out, one of my students said, "Miss Sullivan, can you see the letters on the ship?" And I just got goosebumps. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating discovery, and I'm thrilled for Mr. Allen and his crew for being so dedicated to this.
And even though it's been 76 years since that sinking, an emotional moment for you and your family, I'm sure.
Right. You know, I talked to my dad about it quite a bit the other night, and he said, "I don't know how to explain how I feel to people because I really don't understand it myself." And that's really what sums it up. It's a happy feeling because I'm thrilled that they found this history, but there's also this bittersweet part of it as well.
What can you tell us about the attack that sunk the Juno and cost the lives of nearly 700 American sailors, including your grandfather and your four great uncles?
You know, they actually were hit twice by a torpedo. The first torpedo hit on November 12th during the Battle of Guadalcanal, and they were, you know, that was devastating to the ship, but they were still afloat. And so it was the next morning. The ship, the Juno, was back on its way back to Espiritu Santo for repairs when the final torpedo hit. And from what I've heard from, because I've actually met the survivors, I grew up knowing the 10 survivors of the Juno, which was, you know, a true honor for me. The explosion was just massive, and the ships kept going because they didn't think that there would possibly could be any survivors. So I think that was part of the reason we were so surprised about the discovery. We didn't realize that the ship would be so intact.
Are there stories connected with those last moments from the survivors? What stays with you?
I think the one that stays with me the most is, you know, they were out there for a week. They were left out there for a week. That's a whole other story before anyone came to get them. And so Wyatt Butterfield was one of the survivors, and an airplane had come by and thrown out some supplies. And I remember as a child him telling the story about how he had to swim to go get the supplies, and a shark was coming after him, and he had a knife, and he was fighting the shark off. So, you know, these are real stories of heroes. So those are the kind of things I remember, is thinking about how they were out there for a week before anyone rescued them.
And it's really such an amazing coincidence that on the day of this discovery, it was found last weekend on St. Patrick's Day for the Sullivan brothers, that you were aboard a naval ship named for the Sullivan brothers. I think the USS the Sullivans, right?
That's correct. I think that's the part that really gives me the chills, the serendipity of all of it. You know, And when I go to visit the ship, it's hard to explain, but I feel the spirit of the boys, and not just the five boys, but all of their shipmates, all 700 of the sailors who perished on the Juno. And so when you're on the ship and you're with the crew, and I'm so incredibly proud of the crew of the Sullivans, and I'm sitting on the fantail of the ship. There was a Navy retirement. One of my former captains, Ryan Tillotson, chose to have his retirement ceremony on the Sullivans on St. Patrick's Day. So this discovery was all happening at that time. And when I christened the ship, I added a little part where I said, "May the luck of the Irish always be with you and your crew." And I truly think that the luck of the Irish was with Mr. Allen's crew on that day when they discovered the Juno.
I understand that you've had the opportunity, in fact, this past fall, to speak at a history symposium with nearly 700 families of the Juno victims that came to this symposium. Tell us about that.
You know, it was really neat. It was in Pittsburgh, and so I have a friend that's a priest in Pittsburgh, and he was one of the ones that organized the event, and he did not tell me ahead of time. He kind of surprised me that he was going around to try to find all the family members of the Pittsburgh Juno families. And so I go to this event to do the speech, and there's all these people in there who had loved ones who died on the Juno. But these were just Pittsburgh families. And so it was very powerful because we all share this common bond. It's a tragic bond, but still we're a Navy family. And so I didn't grow up with the big Irish Catholic family that I would have if one of the boys had survived, but I have this amazing Navy family.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw the wreckage of the Juno, that was the first thing I thought of, was all these people that I had met in Pittsburgh, because we all felt very, very drawn to each other and connected in a way that's really hard to describe to people. And I was praying for them and knowing that there's, you know, 700 other families that are feeling the same way that my dad, my brother, and I are.
I bet your third graders, your third grade teacher there in Cedar Falls, they must have all kinds of questions with this bit in the news this week, making such a big impression on the kids, I'm sure.
It has, and I thought about that. They'll never forget their third grade year because of this incredible discovery. They saw it on the news, and they came into school so excited. But, you know, we do a lot with the Sullivans to begin with because the students go to the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum for an event called Museum School, so they learn about it there. It's a program that all third graders in the Cedar Valley have the honor to do. And then I always show The Fighting Sullivans for Veterans Day, and that's always been a big hit.
The Hollywood movie from several years ago.
Correct. So Veterans Day, we always show the Sullivan movie, and the kids love that movie. It's a great movie, and it's a great way to teach kids about patriotism and selfless service.
So what's next, Kelly? With the discovery of this wreck, I mean, it's more than 2.5 miles below the surface off the coast of the Solomon Islands. Any plans?
Well, you know, I do have a goal. You know, I think what I told my students was, you know, Mr. Allen really inspires you. We're a 7 Habits school here at Lincoln, which is Stephen Covey's version for students. It's called Leader in Me. And I said, you know, Mr. Allen was really beginning with the end in mind and being proactive. So my goal is, and I've already contacted the captain of the Sullivans, I said, let's get our operations officer to get the Sullivans to the South Pacific. And it would be great to also bring some Juno families with us and do a wreath laying and a memorial service, you know, at the wreckage. The captain of the USS Juno, Knut Swenson, his grandson is a friend of mine, and Knut Swenson texted me as soon as he heard the news, and it would be great to have the captain's grandson out there as well.
Amazing story. Kelly Sullivan, the granddaughter of Albert Sullivan. Al Sullivan, the youngest of the Sullivan brothers, all died in the sinking of the USS Juno 76 years ago, November 13th, 1942. She's a third grade teacher in Cedar Falls. Kelly, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this very, very important discovery of the USS Juno.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week also, sad news that Sonia Kendrick, the founder of Feed Iowa First, has died. Kendrick was 40 years old. No details from the family on the death. An interfaith service for her will be held this afternoon in Cedar Rapids. Lynette Richards joins us. Lynette Richards is a board member of Feed Iowa First and a friend of Sonia Kendrick, I understand, for many years. Hello, Lynette, and our condolences to you and the rest of those involved in this worthwhile organization that she founded.
Well, thank you, Ben. Thank you for the thoughts, and thank you for having me on today.
Sonia Kendrick founded Feed Iowa First in Cedar Rapids in 2011. Tell us a little bit about how she got the idea to start Feed Iowa First, and then you can comment on what it's grown into today and how many people it's helping.
Okay. Well, as many know, Sonia was a veteran. She was in the National Guard. She served in the Army. She had a tour in Afghanistan. And when she came back, she was a mother with two young daughters. And their family at times turned to food pantries for enough food to have on the table. And what she saw was kindness, generosity, but the quality of the food was mostly processed food. And she felt a strong urge that people needed healthy, fresh vegetables. She also learned when she was serving in Afghanistan that people are controlled by food, that whoever controls the food controls the people. And that sounds radical to us in Iowa, where we feel that we have an abundance, but she found that there really wasn't an abundance of fresh produce. And she started by going to churches and asking if they would grow, not mow, that there are beautiful lawns, but what else could be done with them? And she convinced churches and businesses to start growing food in their big, expansive yards that mm-hmm. they were mowing. And that's how it started. It started with just a few plots, and now there are over 40 sites in Cedar Rapids that grow food for Feed Iowa First.
Mm-hmm. And who receives this food?
Who receives the food?
Yes.
Well, we've made a commitment to every church that grows food. If they have a food pantry, we will have fresh produce available on the days that the pantry is open. And most churches have the rule that a family could access the dry goods at the food pantry once a month. But we would have the veggie bus there every week, so people who came would always have access to the fresh produce. They could have whatever they needed. It was just so rewarding to see how many people appreciated it, how many people shared recipes. If it was a week there were a lot of cucumbers, they'd come back next week with a jar of pickles for Sonia. And there was just that full circle of kindness and generosity that was really rewarding to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. In the final minute or so we have, Lynette, on a personal note, how will you remember Sonia, an image that stands out? I mean, you mentioned the veggie bus, that green, big, repainted school bus, the fresh revolution on the side, Feed Iowa First.
Right.
Yeah?
Yes. I was one of the volunteer drivers for that. And there are two things we're working on. One, doing some fundraising for repairs the bus needs. And one of the ways we're working on that is there's a group of people who planned last week with Sonia how they would do a fundraising bike tour that would visit. It's a combination effort of Feed Iowa First and the Breathing Room Yoga Group, and they're touring vegetable sites, doing outdoor yoga, working with Goldfinch Cyclery, and teaching safety to the people who go on the bikes and doing bike safety checks. And it will be a fundraiser for Feed Iowa First as we carry the work forward.
Okay, thank you very much, Lynette Richards, for helping us remember Sonia Kendrick. Lynette is a board member for Feed Iowa First. Thank you, Lynette.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The NBA's all-time leading scorer, now New York Times bestselling author of Becoming Kareem, is coming to Iowa later this month. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar will give a talk at Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City on March 25th, titled From Kareem to Kaepernick, A History of Political Activism in Sports. It's part of Hancher's Embracing Complexity series that aims to showcase Islamic art and Muslim artists across the world. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
What's your message for Iowans?
I would start out saying that, that Muslims and people that don't look like the average Iowan are not necessarily a threat, and they should not be seen as such.
Last December, you wrote that the NBA and not the NFL is a league of America's future, that football embodies the spirit of a nation as it once was, not as it is today. Explain what you mean by that comment.
Well, I think that the whole idea of the nation being a team, and a team has a lot of different parts to it, it's not homogenous. You know, it's diverse. America has always been diverse, mm-hmm. and that diversity has increased over the years. So what it was like 250 years ago, that's not the way it is right now. And I think that has alarmed some people, but I don't think that should alarm people. The American experiment is a resounding success.
Kareem, you talk about the America as being an experiment, being a resounding success, but yet the idea of diversity, that word, that idea in our country, you know, used to be viewed as good, only good. And now it's a controversial word and something that many people are against, actually.
Well, I think that's unfortunate, you know, the fact that people would get to a point where they see diversity as being a negative, because the diversity of ideas and the diversity of the people who have these ideas makes it possible for us to discover new things. Alexander Graham Bell came from Scotland. You know, the people that do some of these things have to come here to America in order to get the freedom to experiment and do the things. If the Wright brothers tried to invent the airplane now, all the regulations, the safety regulations would make it impossible for them to do their experiment.
Did you pick that out because of the
diet? It's a certain freedom and ability to do things without any restraints. That freedom, I think, really is a key to what makes America so special.
Mm-hmm. Back to the point of your talk in Iowa, political activism in sports, you've said that the NBA has a chance to seize this moment and boldly lead by promoting the values and freedoms of the U.S. Constitution. Do you think the NBA will seize this chance?
Oh, I've seen it happen already. From my very first day in the NBA, when I started my NBA career, I played for the Milwaukee Bucks. The Milwaukee Bucks had the very first black general manager of a professional sports team, Wayne Embry. The NBA has led the way in hiring minority coaches. They have minority ownership. I think the NBA really has led the way. They're starting the Women's League and giving women the chance to coach and be involved in management again. The NBA has led the way in all of those areas.
You've been an advocate for college athletes to receive compensation. When did your mind change on this, or did you feel that way back when you were a college athlete?
Well, when I was a college athlete, it was explained to me how I was being exploited. Okay, I couldn't blame UCLA; they didn't start the system, but universities benefit from it. They don't have to pay the people who put the people in the seats. Football and basketball pay the bill for all of college sports. They pay the salaries, or they pay for the stadiums, everything. The university makes millions of dollars. They have wonderful TV contracts. the head of the NC2A has a multi-million dollar salary. They're all doing very well, and the players, they get nothing. You know, when there's billions being made, the room, board, and tuition is a travesty. I'm not saying that they should be made wealthy, but I think it needs to be a little bit more equitable because they're risking everything when they step out there.
All right. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, thank you for joining us.
Nice talking with you. Thanks for having me.
Just enough time to check in with Mark Simmet, host of IPR Studio One Track, 7 days a week at 7 p.m. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Going to groove us into the weekend as we like to do on Fridays. What do you got for us?
Well, you know, we've talked on this segment, mentioned the fact that perhaps music is a respite from the realities of the world. And, you know, it occurred to me, well, sometimes, you know, artists, musicians can comment on the world or maybe just their own lives. And so that led me to a track from the brand new album by the Decemberists, which just came out in the past week. Really great album, I'll Be Your Girl, the name of it. And there happens to be a track called Everything Is Awful. But it's a, you know, it's a catchy song and kind of like, yeah, everything might be awful, but let's acknowledge it and have a good time.
And it certainly is with the weather this weekend. It looks like. Thanks, Mark Simmet of Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Let's listen.
Everything, 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 everything is awful.
Come on, not everything. River to River, for example, is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, Lindsay Moonen. Help today from Natalia Reyes. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.